So tonight's reading is from 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 to 24. And that can be found on page 1220 of the Church Bibles. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. As I mentioned at the beginning, although our normal practice here, if you're a regular, is to work through sections, books of the Bible, and to think how its teaching applies to our lives, we are doing something slightly different today, which is we're addressing this particular question. If you've got one of those white sheets, the question is there at the top, how can there be just one true religion? There's a pastor writer called Robert Sproul, and shortly after he became a Christian believer whilst he was at university, one of his lecturers made him stand up in front of the class, and the lecturer said, "Mr. Sproul, do you believe that Jesus is the only way to God?" And this guy, Robert Sproul, he says at that moment he just wanted to jump out of the window, because he knew what Jesus himself taught, that he was the only way to God. And yet he also knew how that would come across in the class, and he'd be thought as arrogant. But he was able to kind of hold his nerve, and he said, "Well, yes, I believe that Jesus is the only way." And the lecturer said, "That is the most bigoted, narrow-minded, arrogant statement I have ever heard. How can you believe in a God who is so narrow-minded that he would only provide one way of salvation to the world?" Now, for most people on the street, if you ask them their problem with Christianity, I think most people's answer would be just one word: exclusivity. Maybe you're here today looking at Christianity from the outside, and if that is you, we're thrilled that you're here. You're very welcome. And maybe you find there's a lot about Christianity that's attractive to you. But why is it that Christians then go and spoil it all by saying, "We have the one truth which everyone in the world needs"? It does just sound arrogant. But worse than sounding arrogant, isn't it actually divisive and destructive? So Karl Popper, who's a 20th century philosopher of science, he said, "It is just a short step from the confidence which says, 'I am sure,' to the tyranny which says, 'Therefore, I must be obeyed.'" So 40 years ago, if you'd asked most people what the chief obstacle is to world peace at the moment, I think 40 years ago, most people would have said political ideology. It was the time of the Cold War. And maybe that would have been the same answer most people would have given 20 years ago. But today, I think most people, if they're asked the question, they would say that the barrier to world peace is religion, and specifically religious exclusivity, absolute truth claims. Because if a bunch of people are told, "You have the truth, and you are saved through holding to that truth," that has to lead, doesn't it, to a sense of superiority over the people who are not holding to that truth. And that superiority then leads to a kind of a distancing, a withdrawing from others, separating from them, and in time actually becoming unfamiliar with others. And then eventually we're able to think the worst about those people, so that it becomes easier to mistreat them, or at least to stand by while others do. So that's the argument, isn't it, against absolute truth claims. And one writer who I owe a lot to in thinking through these things, I've mentioned before his book on the bookstall, Reason for God, is Tim Keller. And he says that when people present this argument to him, you know, absolute truth claims lead down the slippery slope, eventually to oppression. His response is to agree. It's true. So I put on those sheets, truth claims are dangerous. And I put a question mark next to that statement. But actually, just cross out the question mark. I'd agree, truth claims really are dangerous. But that is not all there is to say, because I also want us to, well, if it was all there is to say, I could sit down and things would go much quicker tonight. But we're going to crack on, because what I want us to consider is the other 2 points on the sheet. Firstly, that truth claims are unavoidable. So I want us to see that it's not just those dreadful religious people who are making absolute truth claims. Everyone's doing it, but some people are just doing it without realizing. And then finally, there on the sheets, having seen the depth of this problem, truth claims are unavoidable. I want to conclude by looking at the passage that we had read from the Bible, showing from that passage how it is that Christianity actually has a unique way through this problem. Because as the final point says, Christianity is the one truth claim that leads to a love of one's enemies. That's why it's the solution to this problem of division and oppression. So that's a little outline of where we're heading. But first, let's consider that point. Truth claims are unavoidable. Now, the normal solution that is given, at least in our society at the moment, to this problem of truth claims being dangerous, is to try and get everyone, and particularly religious people, to agree that we've each got a valid but partial perspective on the truth. The philosopher John Hick put it like this: the only stable and enduring basis for peace will come about from a mutual acceptance of the world religions as different but equally valid relationships to the ultimate reality. You see, if everyone in the world can agree that we've only got part of the truth and that perhaps others have got parts of it as well, then there's no need for anyone to make exclusive claims, and then there's no need for anyone to fall out with each other. That's the argument. It sounds very sensible, doesn't it? There's a classic illustration of this idea, which many of us will have heard, where the quest for truth is pictured as a mountain. And there's lots of roofs, piles up to the top. And each religion is saying, you know, theirs is the path. You know, everyone has to take my path. But if only we could rise up in a helicopter or something and we could look down on the mountain, we could all see that all these different paths actually lead to the same summit, the same destination. So they're all actually equally valid. And that is a pretty persuasive, pretty compelling picture. Until, of course, you stop and you think about it, and you think about the assumption that has been smuggled into that picture. So if you think about it, the person describing that picture of the mountain is the only person who has the whole truth. They're the only person who's able to tell all the other people on the mountain who are each trekking up each of their different paths what none of them have yet realized. So the person describing the picture is actually subtly, because they're not admitting to this, but they're subtly claiming to know better than anyone else what spiritual reality really is. But bizarrely, that is precisely what they're telling everyone else you're not allowed to say. So the point is that the person who says no one has a superior take on spiritual reality, that itself is a superior take on spiritual reality. I mean, how do they know better than everyone else? And when someone says no one should convert anyone else to their view of spiritual reality, perhaps someone said that to you, in making that statement, that person is actually trying to convert the listener to their view of religious reality. So this approach, I mean, it's very, very widespread in our society. And it sounds very, very humble, but it's not. It's actually imperialistic. It's just another absolute truth claim, but it's subtly pretending that it's not. So I hope we're at least beginning to see that this topic we're examining today is a lot more complicated than we might think at first. Truth claims really are unavoidable. Now, thankfully, even though this is a very widespread view in our society, more and more people are seeing the problem with this supposed solution, the solution of trying to get everyone to agree that we've each got part of the truth. There was an article in The Guardian online last year, you might have read it, about an Oxford student who returned his degree to the university. And he said he did it in protest at the failure of my old college to adequately address the widespread offence caused by them hiring out the college to a fundamentalist Christian group. And he continued, "This group is Christian Concern, who state that their aim is to raise up the next generation of Christian leaders who will take a bold stand for Christ within their spheres of influence. And these adherents want abortion to be made illegal." Now, I don't want to comment on that particular incident or on that particular group. But what was fascinating to me in reading it was the comments section beneath the article. Now, if you read The Guardian, you might expect the comments section to be filled with all kinds of comments which are supportive of this writer's view. But most of them were pointing out exactly what I've just been trying to say, that this student seems to be completely unaware that truth claims are unavoidable, and therefore they can't just be banned or outlawed. So one of the comments went like this: "What this student fails to grasp is his own intolerance. Many students these days are reared in some kind of grievance culture. Yes, they're in favour of diversity, but that doesn't mean they won't condemn people they don't like, any less than a southern firebrand preacher." Or another one went like this: "You are doing something similar to what this religious group is doing. It's just that it looks a far more acceptable target." So more and more people are realising that it's not as simple as just criticising or banning those who are making absolute truth claims. Everyone is at it. Everyone's making absolute truth claims all the time. They're unavoidable. And actually, the most dangerous absolute claims, as we've said, are those which pretend they're not. So I don't know if you've followed me so far, but the question we need to consider now is, where does all this leave us? You know, if, as the first point said, truth claims are dangerous, if they're divisive, but then as the next point says, they're also unavoidable, we're in a pickle. You know, what is the answer? And that brings us onto this final point, something unique about Christianity. As I put there, one truth claim leads to love of enemies. Now, I'm aware as we broach this topic, this might sound just counterintuitive to a lot of people, that Christianity might have something to offer on this. But wonderfully, Christianity does provide a truth claim which leads not to the marginalisation, not to the oppression of those outside the group, but it leads us instead to love and serve those who don't believe what we do. Now, I need to underline at this point, that Christianity is a truth claim. I'm not arguing at this stage that we should believe in Christianity because it leads to love and tolerance, which it does. We believe it because it's true. So Dawkins was right when he said, "It is astonishing how many people can't understand that X is comforting does not imply X is true. You know, the consolation content of the belief does not raise its truth value." So we're not saying believe in Christianity because it works. We're saying believe it because it's true. But I am saying don't be put off Christianity because you think it's arrogant or because you think it's divisive. It is not. And that is what I want us to look at now, that Christianity uniquely leads to this love of enemies. So in a moment, I'm going to read that passage again, that section from 1 Peter 2, which we had read earlier. It's a letter from the Apostle Peter, one of Jesus' followers, to a bunch of early Christians. And these Christians at that time, they're being criticized, they're being oppressed because of their beliefs. And so, of course, in that situation, their temptation is to retaliate. Now, speaking personally, I've faced hardly any injustice in my life. And when I was trying to think of the nearest approximation to it, I do remember one time where a policeman assaulted my friend because the policeman had completely misunderstood the situation. And just that incident, seeing that happen, everything in me welled up. I wanted to shout, I wanted to retaliate. Now, thankfully, my friend is a lot more self-controlled than me, and he just dealt with it very gently and politely. And so I could just kind of watch and calm down. But it did highlight for me, just that one incident, how difficult it is to respond with grace and love when you're mistreated. Perhaps you've got other examples where you've experienced this yourself. But that is exactly what Peter is calling these people to do. So the verse we began with on the front of the sheet says this: do not repay evil for evil, or reviling, insulting for reviling. But on the contrary, bless, for to this you were called. So Peter's saying there, not just don't retaliate. He's saying, like Jesus said before him, love your enemies. You know, do good to those who hate you. That's what Jesus said. And when a group is being mistreated like these early Christians were, at the very least, the temptation is to withdraw into their tribe as a kind of self-protection. But Peter says that is not an option for you, Christians. Now, you've got to look for ways to bless those, to do good to those who oppose you. You've got to serve them. Now, all of this sounds unrealistic, doesn't it? It's a nice idea, perhaps in the abstract, but how on earth does this guy Peter expect Christians to be able to do it? But actually, it is not unrealistic. This is exactly how the early Christians lived. So in the Roman Empire, you may know, it was a very diverse, very pluralistic culture, very much like our own. You know, take your pick from the Roman pantheon of gods. It doesn't particularly matter which one you pick. And so in that context, the Christians stuck out a mile. You know, they were insisting Jesus is God and everyone must worship him. And so naturally, in that context, the Christians were getting a very hard time. So we've got these narrow, exclusive Christians in this open, pluralistic culture. But the lives of these Christians were far more outward focused and inclusive than the rest of the culture. So take, for example, the Christians' attitude to the poor. Now, you may know that the poor were marginalized by that culture. But the Christians at that time, they were known for looking after not just their own poor, but everyone else's as well. Or women. You know, women had a very hard time in Roman society. But the Christians honoured them. They looked after the widows. They took in, they cared for thousands and thousands of female babies whom the rest of society just left out to die. Or in the great plagues which struck the Roman world, particularly in the second and third centuries, when everyone was fleeing the cities and deserting the sick, the Christians were known for staying in the cities and looking after the sick of all faiths, not just their own. And a little later on, the Emperor Julian, who was opposed to Christianity, he commented this: nothing has contributed to the progress of the superstition of the Christians as their charity to strangers. The impious Galileans, that's what he called the Christians, provide not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. So the question is, how is this possible? How is it that these exclusive fundamentalist claims generated such inclusive and beautiful lives? The answer is, it all depends on what your fundamental is. Because the Christian's fundamental, the Christian's ultimate reality, is a man on a cross, loving and sacrificially serving those who don't love him. And that is the reality which Peter points these Christians to. So let me read from 1 Peter 2, which we had read, verse 20. If when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. He, Christ, committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. So Christians, almost by definition, are those who see this act, this event in history, God himself dying for his enemies, we see it as the most beautiful, glorious, wonderful action imaginable. And we don't just admire this act from a distance. We are actually connected to it. So the next verse says, he, Jesus, bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. He loved us. He died for us, in spite of what it is we deserve. And if that becomes the very heart of who we are, if that reality of a human being sacrificing himself, praying for his enemies, even as he's being butchered by them, if that reality sinks into the depths of our being, it will produce the kind of love that these early Christians displayed, the most inclusive possible life out of the most exclusive possible claim. Now, I gave the example of the early church because it's very well documented and because it's quite an obvious one, but I could easily have given the example of church life here at the Barge. By God's grace, the Barge really is a place where all kinds of people who wouldn't naturally connect are drawn in and cared for and loved. In fact, only this week somebody told me that what first drew him to the Barge was the depth of community that he could see here. And it was only later, he said, he discovered what was underneath all the love and kindness he saw. And that is God's kindness to us. So it's true that we do have an absolute truth claim. But what is that truth claim? It's that there is a God who became weak and who loved and died for the very people who opposed him. So as we consider this question we're looking at today, how there can be just one true religion, how is it that Christians can make such absolute truth claims? We need to step back first, and we need to acknowledge, you know, everyone has got a set of absolute truth claims, beliefs. We can't avoid it. But what makes Christianity unique is that it leads to the most inclusive behavior. So if you and I were to take moralism or religion into our lives, we will always feel better than those dreadful secularists. Or if we take secularism into our lives, we'll always feel better than those stupid religious people. But if we take the gospel into our lives, into the centre, we will be humble before people who don't believe what we do. You know, we are no better than anyone else. We're just sinners saved by the kindness of God. And therefore, as we do that, we will seek to serve those very people who are not like us. Because our whole life is centered on this person who loved those who didn't love him. You see, this is the truth claim that our world so desperately needs. But it's not simply that the world, it's not simply the world which needs this truth claim. You and I, everyone here, we all need it personally. So do you remember that new Christian I was talking about at the beginning, Sproul? Robert Sproul, he was asked, how can you believe in a God who would only provide one way of salvation? And he answered the question like this: I don't know why God hasn't given us five saviors or 15 ways to satisfy him. But let's suppose there is a God. And suppose that God is absolutely holy. And suppose that God, not out of necessity, but out of sheer love, creates a world, and his crowning act of creation is a creature that he shapes in his own image. And he breathes into this creature his own breath. And he gives this creature preeminence over creation and gives him the task of mirroring and reflecting God's own holy character. And God gratuitously heaps all kinds of benefits on this creature, but gives him just one restriction. And as soon as God turns his back, suppose this creature, which owes his creator everything, turns around and grasps for equality with his creator and openly, willfully defies the law of God. And God had told him, you do this, you die. and suppose right then that God would erase mankind from the earth, he would have been perfectly just to do it. But suppose God was so patient, so kind, that he said, I will promise to deliver this ungrateful sinner from this desperate condition. I'm going to send to this people that reject everything I do for them, I'm going to send my only son. And I'm going to take the sins of my people and transfer them onto the back of my only son, who is perfectly righteous and perfectly innocent. And they kill the son. And God said, that's okay. You killed him. But if you will just put your trust in him and honor him, I will forgive you of every sin that you have committed against me. And I will give you eternal life where there will be no more death. But my only requirement is that you honor the one who has died in your place. Buddha didn't die for you. Moses didn't die for you. Muhammad didn't die for you. And I require you that you honor and embrace my only son. And Sproul concluded, as we're going to today, with these questions. Would you dare to stand before God on the day of judgment and say, God, you have not done enough. One way of salvation is not enough. I guess there may be all kinds of questions, objections, comments surfacing in your mind. But what I suggest we do now is have a moment's quiet to reflect on what we've heard. We will have time for questions at the end. And then after a time of quiet, we will... the musicians will start and we'll sing this next song about God, our servant king.